Hello, I'm Sarah Vine, and this is Sarah Vine's Female Half Hour from Mail Plus. I am flying solo this week. Emerton's off doing more important things. But coming up later in the show, you'll be able to hear an interview that she and I recorded last week with Kate Bailey, the curator of a brilliant new show at the Victoria and Albert titled Diva. But first, new research has shown that many people have given up on trying to see their GP when feeling unwell, and that those who do get an appointment often think the care they receive isn't of the standard that they'd expect. Joining me now is John Doyle, principal lawyer in the medical negligence department at Slater and Gordon, and one of his clients, Nikki. Hi, guys. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, sir.
So, Nikki, tell us your story.
Okay, where to begin? So, unfortunately, recently, I was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. But my story kind of starts throughout the process of being diagnosed. So start of last year, I started experiencing symptoms, including abdominal bloating, pain in my pelvis, pain in my back. I was struggling to walk. I was struggling to sleep laying flat. So I was having a lot of symptoms that didn't kind of go along with any of the health conditions that I had. Went to the GP. They sent me for further tests at the hospital. And then for the best part of a year, I spent in and out of A&E, back and to the doctors, back and to the different hospitals, trying to get somebody to listen to me. The pain wasn't going away and nobody could find out what was wrong with me.
And you're very young, Nikki. How old are you?
Yeah, I was 26 when I was diagnosed and I've recently turned 27.
That is awful, awful. And why do you think your doctor wouldn't listen to you?
I think there's a few reasons. Firstly, I think it comes down to women's health, to be honest. I think there was a lot of assumptions made, whether that was kind of intentional or not. I think some of that can come down to kind of things like unconscious bias, which we all have, don't we? I think a lot of the time I was fobbed off with things like mental health. It could just be period pains. Have you eaten something? Food intolerances. And I knew it was none of these things.
But do you think that because you're so young, they just thought there can't be anything seriously wrong with this person?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was dismissed a lot of times. The age and the gender both come into that.
Did you have any other medical conditions beforehand? I mean, had you been ill before?
Yeah, I've had IBS for over 10 years, so I knew the signs and symptoms of that. And to be honest, it's difficult because ovarian cancer, a lot of the symptoms are quite general. Can't be misdiagnosed.
And did you feel in your heart that there was something really seriously wrong?
The further time went on, the more I started to worry, but I never in a million years thought it could be cancer.
No.
I did know that.
No, I mean, because A, you're so young, you just don't think that. I mean, I remember being your age and it would never occur to me that that could happen. So the hospital didn't find anything the first few times you went. Did you feel that they just weren't equipped to deal with your symptoms? I mean, there's been this big report out recently saying that, you know, the NHS is at the bottom of the pile in terms of treatment, pretty much at the bottom of the pile. Do you think that it's to do with, I don't know, poor quality of staff? I mean, what were the obstacles that you encountered?
I think there was issues with my age, issues with my gender that I had to overcome. I found it very difficult a lot of the time when speaking to healthcare professionals. I don't feel like they treated me like I had the intelligence to understand what was wrong with my health. So it's quite sad, but towards the end of that period of time, I started using buzzwords and I started dropping them into conversation, and you would see the conversation change and you'd see the terminology change. I don't know what it is, whether it's, I think it's a contribution of GPs and doctors under pressure, understaffed, not enough time with patients. I think some of it comes down to they need to potentially retrain and have a bit more education around listening to the patient. I think there was a lot of that involved as well.
And when you went to your GP, what was their initial response?
It's quite a shocking story, actually. The first time I went to the GP, they did some blood tests. One of the blood tests was raised. And they said, this blood test can indicate things like infection, but it can also indicate things like cancer. Now that I know now, because I did an access request through the data protection law, that message was sent across to the hospital. And in black and white, I have read well early in the year, please scan this female. We are extremely concerned regarding ovarian cancer. And it was ignored.
It was ignored by the hospital.
It was ignored by everybody who ever saw that message, because nobody thought to look down that route. Otherwise, I would have been diagnosed much earlier on.
So your diagnosis took how long exactly?
Well, I went to the doctors in March and I was diagnosed in November.
But ovarian cancer is fast, isn't it? We know that.
Some forms of ovarian cancer are quite aggressive. However, some are quite slow growing. When I was diagnosed, the doctor said to me at the time, unfortunately, the reason we think it's cancer is because we've got the previous scans from a different hospital, the reason we think it's cancerous is because we can see that it was there and it was also there and it's grown. So the reason what makes my case so much more shocking is the what if it could have been caught sooner. My cancer was really advanced. I was stage 3C, so bordering stage 4. I'm now facing a terminal diagnosis, whereas if they may have found it earlier, this might not be.
If they found it stage 2, would it probably be much easier to deal with?
Much easier to contain, much easier to treat.
So you're wearing a fantastic headdress, which looks great. Very fashionable colour, lime green. And so you've obviously been having chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And how many rounds? What's your treatment plan?
So initially, when I was diagnosed in Sheffield, they told me I was inoperable and they could try chemo, but it's my type of cancer is very resistant to chemotherapy. Mm. I've got a rare form of ovarian cancer. So they said we can give it a try, but there's not much else we can do. So I battled and advocated for myself and got a second opinion. So I'm now being treated at the Christie in Manchester, who I can't speak highly enough of. They reconsidered the decision and they took a chance and they operated. And the operation was like miracle level.
Wow.
Had really, really extensive life-changing surgery. And as an estimate, they say they managed to get about 99% of it.
Wow, that's amazing. So they're just going to try and zap the rest?
Those parts they can't remove and they will never cure me. But I asked for chemotherapy as a second, the kind of standard of care, I think that most people seem to think best level of treatment is operation and then chemotherapy. Mm. Now, chemo might not work for me and my cancer will always be there. Mm. It will keep coming back until...
What about immunotherapy? Are you eligible for that?
No, that's not been discussed with me. The next stage is hormone therapy. So the same treatment they use for breast cancer, letrozole. And I'll be on that for the rest of my life.
And how are you feeling? How have you coped with it physically?
It's been an absolute marathon.
Yeah.
Not just a physical marathon, but a mental marathon. I think, and I'm still trying to find a way to come to terms with it all, but I think one thing that helps me is using it proactively and using it positively to make a change to something else. My life is what it is. I can't change that now. This is my outcome. But if I can at least raise awareness or save somebody's life through teaching them how to advocate for themselves, then this has all been worth it.
But also incredibly brave of you to insist on having an operation when they were telling you not to bother having an operation. And actually you've had the operation and they've taken out 99% of it. You could say that operation was experimental, but actually for you, it's been the right thing to do. And someone else might have just taken that diagnosis and thought, okay, fine, that's it. I'll just curl up in a corner and die. But you didn't.
It's really scary because that's quite funny you say that. That was what I used to say. I said, imagine if I just said, okay, plug me in, carry on. You know, we're socialised and we're brought up to believe the doctor knows best. And I think that's kind of what needs to change in the shift in attitude is that actually you know best about what's going on in your body.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that as a mother of 2 small children, whenever they were ill, I always knew best. I mean, I had a situation where my son was very, very ill and I knew something was seriously wrong with him. And I kept taking him to the doctor and the doctor kept saying, no, 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 it's fine. You're just being neurotic. And then in the end, it turns out he had mastoiditis and nearly died and had to have a hole drilled in the side of his brain so they could drain an abscess. But, you know, people know when there's something really... That's why I asked you earlier, did you sort of vaguely know in your bones that there was something wrong? Well, it's an incredible story. I have to say, well done you, because as you said, you know, we are brought up to believe that doctors know best, but quite often they don't. And more it seems that they don't. So I just want to go to John. So John, tell me what your situation is and what your relationship is with Nikki and what you're trying to do for her.
So I think one of those things that Nikki's case, unfortunately, isn't entirely rare. And it's one of those things that we often get patients, clients come to us in very similar scenarios and with unfortunately very similar stories, and that's unfortunately why they need legal advice. But Nikki's story is actually encompasses a number of different points, and it's reattending the GP with what are described as common things are common and therefore sent away and ignored effectively when she's advocating. You touched on something there, and it's no doubt one of those things that people ask you when you take your child to the GP, how are they with themselves, you know, and it's about they're unwell, but actually they seem a bit all right. You know, they're generally, they're not themselves. They're out with what you know. And it's the same thing when they haven't got a voice, you're trying to explain that. And that's what Nikki was trying to do for the GP. Eventually she was referred. There is a referral saying investigate for ovarian cancer. And there is a scan which identifies abnormalities. And you know, you rely on the consultant who's looking at this scan. It says in the June 2022 abnormality query ovarian question mark,
and it wasn't followed up.
it's looked at by a consultant, and we're not absolutely at all bashing doctors or bashing the NHS, and it's not about that, because essentially she had to push and push and push to be in the right place. She's where she thinks she needs to be and or is in the right place, you know, being assessed by obstetrician gynecologist with a special interest in masses, and they're looking for something, despite which she's then sent away. And it's not until November, December of the same year whereby they look at the previous scan and identify actually, yeah, or make a comparison, say, yes, the abnormality we were aware of in June is now much worse. And therefore, you know, we've lost an opportunity, which is even more frustrating, having thought you've got to the way you need to be, to then not be treated for the thing that you've been sent there for. And so it's incredibly frustrating. So a mutual friend put Nick in touch and sort of said, you need to take some legal advice. It's one of those that, you know, we often champion. And one of the things that we're pushing is to raise awareness so that people can advocate for themselves to avoid being the subject of.
But also, I think if you're ill, it's even harder to stand up for yourself, isn't it? Because if you're not feeling well, it's, you know, you don't really have the energy. I mean, Nikki, do you have support, relatives, friends, family?
Yeah, so I've got a long-term partner, Dave. I've got really supportive friends and family, but I don't think anybody apart from Dave really realised what I was going through. And, you know, the likes of my auntie and people I'm really close to, and my family, my mom, my nan, they were so shocked and so saddened to hear that I'd gone through a whole year of that. And they didn't really realise. They knew I was unwell. They knew I was campaigning and trying to get help. But then when I was diagnosed with cancer, it was like an even more of a shock that this had gone on for so long and they didn't know about it. And there was times, and it's quite scary, where I nearly did give up. I just started to think, this is what normal life's like. This level of pain is normal for me. You know, I was going to work on 8 codeine a day, getting a taxi because I couldn't walk, sleeping, sitting upright. There's no quality of life that.
No, that's horrific. And, you know, people often say, when it comes to cases like yours, where you're basically effectively suing the NHS for negligence, you know, people say, oh, you shouldn't sue yet in the NHS because it's the NHS, it's taxpayers' money, it's not fair, you get the money and then that will mean that other people won't get the services they need or deserve. Do you think that's a reasonable stance to take, or how do you feel about that, Nikki?
I feel that I can't speak highly enough of parts of the NHS, and that this is my mission, is to slate the NHS. I'm being treated by the NHS under Christie, and I've had a life-changing operation there. There are some amazing doctors, consultants, but my concern is that I feel that somebody needs to take accountability for what's happened with me, and a lesson needs to be learned so that it doesn't happen to anybody else. That's all I want to happen.
I think you're right. I mean, what are her chances, John? What do you think? Because probably anything else, presumably you can't work now, Nikki. Is this correct?
Yeah, I've been out of work since the diagnosis last year.
Yeah.
Chemo at the moment. I've got another one in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, I mean, but if they'd caught it earlier, then you wouldn't be in this situation. So, you know, you need help.
I took 4 months out of work last year. I couldn't work. I couldn't walk to work. I couldn't walk around work. And I was asking for reasonable adjustments, and work were great with me. But it got to the point where I just couldn't. I'd been in hospital for a week and I still couldn't go to work.
Yeah. So, John, what do you think? I mean, what's the likelihood of Nikki being able to get some sort of recompense?
So there's a couple of points. I think the attitude towards suing the NHS is a common one. It's one of those, there is a reluctance. And actually, that's what some patients are very much of the mindset that, you know, they accept what's gone on. I think it's until you meet somebody like Nikki with a catastrophic change in her lifestyle that, and somebody gets to know somebody like Nikki, that they realise that actually there needs to be some accountability for that. But it's quite right. And the threshold for successfully suing somebody is so high. It's not claims aren't settled just frivolously, you know, that genuinely meritorious claims. And we have a fantastic relationship with the NHS Resolution. And we work collaboratively with them because they know that our clients are clients with, you know, very, very reasonable expert back cases, and the standard, I say, to successfully establish negligence is very high. So with Nikki's, there's clearly been a delay and a misdiagnosis. That's that goes to a particular element of breach of duty, which we have to establish. With Nikki's, it's a rare form of cancer, and she was at a late stage by the time she was diagnosed. What we will do is we'll refer and instruct independent medical experts who will essentially extrapolate backwards as to what the likely stage of the cancer would have been at the point they should have and could have made the diagnosis to give us a projection as to prognosis at that point. And then it's not for me, and I'd have to defer to greater minds on what that is oncologically. And so that's the element which will be the key part of Nikki's case. I think she's got a very strong case on the breach. There are clearly failings in the system, but also the advice she was given afterwards, it was, you know, chemotherapy or HRT and off you go. And she could have been, if she'd have accepted that advice, then she probably
would. Yeah, it seems to me those are the two main factors. Who was the person who missed that original note saying, we're worried about cancer, could you please look at this? And then why did they try to, you know, basically, I mean, you're a 26-year-old girl. You know, I can understand if you're 100 years old like me and they think, well, it's probably not worth wasting all that money on an old bird. But I mean, you're a young woman. You know, you'd have thought that you would be right at the top of the list in terms of priority for this sort of thing.
I think that's what's sad and scary. You know, there's elements of treatment which I've asked for, you know, in terms of having chemotherapy, there's different ways you can have it. Mm. I was struggling each time I was having cannula fitted. I asked for certain things in certain hospitals, was laughed at and said, nice try, next question. And then I go to a different hospital and there's a complete different approach. It's straight away, absolutely, you should have that. That's what you need.
But also, nice try. I mean, sorry, you've got serious ovarian cancer. Why would anybody speak to you like that?
That's just, honestly, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
That's really awful. That's just, it's not only rude, it's kind of cruel as well. It's not your fault you've got ovarian cancer.
To be spoken to like that when I'm coming to terms with the fact that I'm going to die from having cancer.
And you're not going to have children, you're not going to have a family. I mean, that's your whole life. And what's a nice try? When am I, of course you're going to try. You should try everything. No, that's, I don't know what that is. I don't really know what, there's a word to describe how unpleasant that sort of behaviour is.
It's also highlighted there's a real disconnect and lack of communication across trusts in different parts of the country. Yeah. When, you know, it got to it when Nikki was asking questions about treatment options and they kind of said, well, there's nothing, you know, we've kind of, computer says, no, we've reached the end of what we think we can do for you. And it's not a joined up approach to say, we know our colleagues over at the Christie are doing fantastic work. We haven't got the skill set. And there's nothing wrong with saying we haven't got the skill set or the funds or the ability to do it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. And you'd actually hope people are quite upfront and frank about saying that. But when you've got people who are more than capable to say, this is our bag, this is what we do, refer it to us. It might be a rare cancer, but we treat rare cancers. You know, we know about it. There's literature. This is what we are going to do to give you the best chance of surviving. Mm. Everybody should be afforded that opportunity.
But it seems to me is a combination of lack of joined up thinking, lack of collaborative thinking between departments, but also a fundamental sort of betrayal of the Hippocratic Oath, which is you're supposed to try and do everything you can to save a person's life.
It's a duty of care, isn't it?
Yeah. And if they're saying to you, nice try, then I don't think that really seems to me that that's in the spirit of what medicine should be about. And, you know, quite aside from your physical difficulties, it must be very difficult. It must be very depressing to have something like this. I can't imagine, you know, the mental sort of anguish. I find that really shocking.
It's taken me some time to come to terms with the diagnosis and to find the fire in me again, because there was a period of time where I was very angry. I was very upset. I was heartbroken and I still am. You know, it's turned my world upside down and the rest. There's been times where the only way I could describe it is, if you were to look behind me, all my buildings would be falling down. Mm. Everything. But it's taken me a little while to get my fire back. But for some people, that would completely knock them.
Yeah. Well, you're obviously a very strong young lady and you have a bit of fire in you. But for someone who was, you know, a different personality, they might have just taken it lying down.
Of course, well, that's scary.
Well, I hope that, I don't know, I hope that you get as many years as you possibly can.
Thank you, I'm determined.
Yes, good. And I hope your story gets out there. And thank you very much for doing this. I wish you both, I mean, I do wish you the best of luck. Thank you very much, Nikki. If you want to follow Nikki on social media, she is at The Big Noodle Queen on Instagram. Thanks very much to Nikki and John Doyle of Slater and Gordon for joining us today. The V&A's latest exhibition is a celebration of the power and creativity of iconic performers, including Marilyn Monroe, Shirley Bassey and Maria Callas. Mm. The show delves into the origins of the term diva and explores how the label has been subverted, embraced and reclaimed over time. Kate Bailey is the curator of the exhibition and she joins us now. Now, Kate, I'm so glad you joined us, because when I got the press release for this and it said diva, mm-hmm. I thought, right, we got to do something on this, because, you know.
You need your own stand, I think, darling.
I do. I need my own stand at the V&A. But it's such a great idea, because the term diva, it has always been quite a derogatory term for a sort of annoying, demanding woman. You know, you think of Mariah Carey wanting to, you know, have a room full of kittens and
white orchids or whatever it is.
But you've sort of turned that notion on the head and made it into sort of a kind of exhibition to celebrate. It's going to be a blockbuster, I think.
I hope so. I guess we started looking at the term diva, and its origins were always a term associated with goddess. It comes from the Latin. It comes from
divine.
So actually I had curated an exhibition about opera, and the diva is obviously paramount in opera, and I kept thinking, why is this term that originates in performance in really widely in the 19th century in opera become so negative? So that kind of curiosity, and then how it has sort of moved into different genres, was the sort of starting point.
Can a man be a diva, or is it just a female term?
Well, I think what the exhibition explores is that there's a myriad of meanings and different definitions of the term over time. Mm. And there's definitely a sort of fluidity to the kind of concept of the diva. Mm. And some men purely embrace it. I mean, there's examples. We've got a fabulous Elton John outfit in the exhibition.
Yeah, you've got the one which has sort of got a huge train of feathers, of white feathers. So is it mainly clothes? Is it mainly based around clothes, or is there other stuff in there?
Lots of other objects, because it's a performance-based exhibition. Mm. So you sort of begin with the 19th century and then move through to the present. Mm. And obviously the costumes and dress are a great way to represent the individual divas. But as well as that, we have some makeup, we have photography, we have visual arts.
What is the essence of a diva? Yes. What were your criteria? How do you get into the diva show at the V&A?
Well, the exhibition follows a story. Mm. So it's following the kind of origins of the term and then how it's been adopted and adapted and subverted and embraced. So the narrative is sort of using the divas to tell that story as opposed to it being like a hall of fame. So we have structured the exhibition into sort of three acts. So the first act looks at a chronology, and that's from the 1830s through to the 1960s. So it kind of follows the first wave of feminism and looks at the term being used from opera through to film, silent movies, Hollywood. And then the second section, we look a bit more thematically at actually from the 60s onward, this term is really used in rock, pop, soul, and embraced in many, many different ways. So we look at a thematic sort of structure that sort of celebrates the attributes of divas. So
I always think that a diva has to have an element of tragedy about it. You've got to be,
exhibitionism.
Have a tragic, so, you know, people like Cher, they're divas because they've overcome pain. I think that's quite an important thing. So someone like, I notice I've got the book here, which is beautiful. There's people like Josephine Baker in here, who were all people who sort of had a lot of adversity in their lives, but still managed to sort of be fabulous and be famous. Is that part of it, do you think? And is that why the costumes and the expression is so out there and outrageous? Mm. Because it's just a sort of, all the emotions seem to be magnified.
It's a really interesting thread that kind of runs through from those opera divas who were performing these roles,
like
these
tragic
heroines. And there's definitely an element that the diva is, it has a strong sense of self and is pushing the status quo, and often there's struggle with that. Mm. So the exhibition does showcase these stories. So Josephine Baker is one. You know, she was able to kind of use her platform as a dancer and as an entertainer to then fight for civil rights. Mm. And then contemporary performers do the same with their voice, finding their voice, being heard. But the tragedy, of course, we sort of finish the end of our first act with Callas because there's something about her as a sort of personification of the kind of old style diva. Mm. And of course, you know, she was singing in all these tragic roles and then had a really kind
of tragic life herself.
So I think that's an important, in terms of the diva sort of mythology, it's an important kind of way that the term has been used and interpreted.
Yeah.
How do you practically go about trying to do an exhibition like this? Does it involve a lot of telephone calls and letters and people sending
so many
ostrich
costumes.
Feathers through the post? I mean, tell me, and how long has
ostrich
it been?
Ostrich feathers through the post.
Feathers.
A lot of feathers.
A lot of
sequins. Are there some sequins?
Oh, there's a lot of sequins.
And many wigs, I would imagine.
Yes.
I'm surprised Joan Collins isn't in this exhibition.
Well, I was just about to say that.
Maybe you could get her to appear in person.
Maybe she should open it.
She should open it. much, yes.
But I mean, how practical is it? Did you say it was 5 years in the making? So
The idea was proposed when I was curating a show about opera,
yes,
and looking at the sort of opera diva. These things take generally 2 to 3 years of kind of serious planning because we've got loans from around the world. There's a core of the exhibition that comes from the V&A collection.
Yeah.
So we have theatre and performance collection. So I was able to kind of go into our stores and find all this amazing kind of material that belonged to the early divas, even material belonging. We have collections relating to Tina Turner and Debbie Harry. And so that's sort of coming from the V&A itself.
Mm.
And then more broadly, yes, research.
Did you go and raid the Royal Opera House's
archives?
Yes. What did you get from there?
The Royal Opera House, the Callas gowns that we have in the show come from the Royal Opera House. And actually, it's the first and the last roles that she performed there.
Oh, my goodness. What are they?
She performed as Norma, Bellini's Norma, which is the Casta Diva, and we begin with that track in the exhibition.
So where are they kept, those costumes?
The archives.
The archives of the Royal Opera
House. Where are the archives? Was it like going in? Is it sort of smell of naphthalene, mothballs?
No, it doesn't actually, because the Opera House have some of their store in Covent Garden, but some of it is in Thurrock and Lakeside, where they've also got their working kind of costume studios and paint studios now. So it feels like very living, breathing, but also a kind of...
I once went to the National Theatre costume store. Have you ever been there?
Gosh.
Because I had to go to a fancy dress party and the theme was Fin de siècle. And so I went, you can hire the costumes.
No.
They are amazing. They're from all of the plays. You go in, I don't know if you can still do it. It was 20 years ago now, so maybe they've stopped it.
In Vauxhall, isn't it?
It's in Vauxhall, yes. And you make an appointment and you go along.
Yeah.
And you go into this enormous hangar and it is full of unbelievable costumes.
I'd disappear there for days.
It is so much fun.
Yes.
Honestly.
How did you get this job? What's your background?
Yes, why can't I?
Why can't I do it? It sounds brilliant. I mean, seriously, how do you become a curator of an exhibition as glorious as this?
I studied art history
many
years ago. Yeah. And my first job was actually working in a museum where we created a theatrical installation around, in fact, just down the road, Leighton House Museum.
Oh, okay.
So my first
job. That's great, that museum.
My first job was actually putting in theatre into Leighton House Museum.
Okay.
So after I'd done my art history. And then I joined the theatre collections nearly 20 years ago. It's quite a long time.
Yeah.
And so I've been working on the collections and exhibitions since. So I did the Alice show and the opera show. And
there's a real trend now for these sort of exhibitions.
I bet, yes.
There's a real thing for these exhibitions, which are sort of cultural as much as artistic, aren't they? I mean, they're sort of very popular and populist.
Yes.
But there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think they really spark people's imagination.
Well, the David Bowie one they did. Yes. Do you remember that? I mean, people were queuing around the block for that.
And also the merchandise for the David Bowie one was very nice. What's, where do you get, is there going to be lots of diva stuff in the shop? I'm sorry to bring it down to you.
There is.
Do you want a fan?
Do you know what?
Crass commercialism.
Oh my goodness, I should have bought you the fan. And in fact, I should have bought the tote bag. Sorry, you just got the book. But
you, Debbie, a fan.
The only reason that we asked you on was to get the tote
bag. The shop is just being finished, but I will get you a tote bag. And it's a tote bag that's black and gold and it says Diva. It's
okay, that is going to sell like a quantity.
And the range is, as you would imagine, there are sunglasses, there are
feathers,
there's jewellery, there's some
makeup. Oh my goodness, we're going.
Yeah, the tote bag is
Oh my,
is
that's
fun.
Brilliant. So what's your favourite thing that you've got in there? What's your most exciting?
What's the thing that you secretly tried on?
Oh, I'd lose my job if we did that. That I'd want to try on. Well, we have this extraordinary Rihanna Versace.
Oh, that thing, which is made entirely out of crystals.
Yes, it's Maison Margiela, and she wore it to a Met Gala. And when it came in, it was jaw dropping.
Mm.
The crystals on it, the weight of it. It was a Pope outfit. It was really sort of really iconic, and she wore it with amazing Louboutin heels. So that was pretty amazing. But then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got this really fragile, beautiful costume from 1917 worn by Theda Bara and Cleopatra, and it's just
cobweb or something.
We sort of
you've got the dress from Some Like It Hot, the Marilyn Monroe dress, the black one with the feathers, with the sort of shimmy skirt.
How beautiful.
And it's quite interesting because I'm seeing a picture of it here on her. It looks completely different off her.
I
she was extraordinary. know. You just put.
She made something.
There was that thing that they said about her that she could wear a potato sack and she still looked fabulous. Yes. And then they photographed her. It's so true because the dress on the mannequin just looks. It looks horrible. It looks like a sort of nasty sort of nylon.
Oh, you're totally right. It looks really dull.
Really dull. And then on her, it's just sort of.
She gives it va-va-voom.
And actually, in the exhibition, we show the dress and there's something kind of quite mesmerising about the fact that she wore it. And then alongside it, you see the scene of the film of her wearing it.
That really is an iconic dress for me. I love that film.
We have lots of Bob Mackie costumes in the show and he did the sort of Cher costumes and the Tina Turner flame dress.
Yes.
They're pretty amazing. I think we were kind of jaw-dropped when they arrived.
So where are these costumes, if they're not in your exhibition? Where's the Rihanna Crystal outfit?
They've come from many different sources. Some of them are in museums in the States, some of them are in private collections, some of them the artists themselves have lent them, designers have lent them. It's a real mixture.
Gosh.
Well, I can't wait. I'm going to go on Saturday and get my tote bag that says Diva. Thank you, Kate. That was brilliant.
Thank you so much.
That was Kate Bailey, curator of Diva, which runs until April next year at the V&A. We will put a link in the show notes. Are we going to fight over the book now, Imogen?
Yes, I know. I think yes.
I'm just going to hit you on the head with it. Yes,
it's just so good.
Thank you.
If you enjoy listening to The Half Hour, why not visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you would like to get in touch, tweet me at WestminsterWag. You have been listening to The Female Half Hour with me, Sarah Vine. Thank you for listening.